Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, and it's great that you could join the program today. We're going through Namkar Pel's text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, and have reached the preliminary meditations. Last week, we finished considering the value of this human existence and how difficult it is to be born a human. You might remember the Buddha used the metaphor of a turtle to illustrate how difficult it is to attain this human existence. He told of a blind turtle that lived at the bottom of a very large ocean. At the top of the ocean, a yolk with a single hole in it is floating, driven by the wind first this way and that. What are the chances of the turtle coming up for air and putting its head perfectly through the hole in the yolk, do you think? Attaining a human rebirth, which is only one out of a great many rebirths in the Buddhist belief system, is more rare than that. So you can see that chancing upon this human rebirth is very uncommon. Even if we just consider the planet Earth that we know, we can see that compared to the number of non-human beings, that is mammals, insects, birds, fish and reptiles, and even smaller creatures such as bacteria and so on, the number of humans is very small. We might think that our number at 7.349 billion is pretty huge, but how can we possibly count all the other creatures on the planet? I like to use an example, a super colony of Argentine ants that stretches 6,000 kilometers from Portugal to Italy along the Mediterranean coast, for over 900 kilometers along coastal California, and for over 400 kilometers in Japan. It has recently been found that this colony has also established itself in Australia and New Zealand. Now, an average Argentine ant is only about 3 millimeters long. So you can imagine just how difficult it is to calculate how many ants are in this super colony. We are talking here of only one ant colony. What can we possibly say about the number of the rest of the non-human beings that we can come across on our planet? Multiply that by all the non-humans in all existence, and we can see what the Buddha meant when he said that compared to all rebirths, being born human is like the dust that would fit on the tip of a finger, compared to the dust covering the whole earth. The human form is so valuable because it's regarded as the best to practice the Dharma with. We have a good intelligence, we have the power of speech, and we have the right psychic body. Compare our situation to any in the animal realm, and we can easily see that all other creatures on earth would find it very difficult to practice the Dharma. Out of all those ants in the super colony, how many would even be able to meditate briefly on loving-kindness? How many would even have a thought of loving-kindness? After contemplating how rare and valuable our human rebirth is, we moved last week on to considering impermanence, and especially death. Impermanence is one of the cornerstones of Buddhist philosophy, and the Tibetan Buddhists focus mainly on what it means for life. It does mean, of course, death. It is obvious that most of us avoid the subject of death as much as possible, because in Western society, thinking about death is regarded as morbid. Almost like if you think about it, you're making it happen. From a Buddhist perspective, that's a big mistake, because thinking about death is very useful for getting Dharma practice into top gear. The text we are following mentions three points in relation to dying, namely that death is inevitable, its time of coming is uncertain, and only the practice of Dharma we have done will be of any use when we die. Last week, we covered the first point, that death is inevitable, and you may remember, if you were with us, that Namkar Pel quotes a verse that goes, "Wherever you live, you are not immune to death. neither on earth in any direction, nor in space, nor within the ocean, nor if you were to hide amidst the mountains. No matter where you go, you will find death there, whether it's on the top of the highest mountain or at the bottom of the deepest sea. Nobody can protect us from death. No doctor or shaman, not even a highly realized lama, not even the Dalai Lama, who must himself die at some stage. All the Dalai Lamas have died so far, all 13 of them, and the Dalai Lama consciousness is regarded by many followers as enlightened. Even the Buddha had to die, so we ordinary beings can't expect to be an exception. The point of considering that death is inevitable is to spur our practice. We have no excuse such as, well, I can put practice off till later because I don't know whether I will die or not. We definitely can't say anything like that. We will face our death one day or another, and with that prospect definitely on the horizon, we should think of preparing for it. There are two other points to ponder when considering the inevitability of death. Death is constantly approaching, and up to now, we haven't spent much time preparing for death. However, before going on into this, let's set our motivation as we usually do. In Nectar 22, Wisdom Waters of Universalism, the author D.S. Lokanath writes in an article headed Good in the Beginning, the Middle and End, Bodhicitta is the altruistic motivation that our individual practice will lead to the same result for all beings that we wish for ourselves. At a deeper level, when we wish that all beings have happiness and freedom from suffering, and that all beings realize the innate, liberated and enlightened nature, then very skillfully we are practicing the bodhicitta motivation and automatically are accomplishing our own most cherished wishes without resorting to spiritual selfishness. This is because we, the ones making the prayer for all beings, also belong to that same set of all beings. So it's therefore very advantageous to at least try to develop a bodhicitta motivation for whatever we do, but as we're here now, at least for this program. Let's then just take a short moment to consider our motivation, and if we see something falling short of bodhicitta, to change it. However, if you can't do that, at this stage, at least motivate for your own liberation. Thank you. On the website The Thrill of the Fall, I found a short piece of writing titled The Ephemeral Nature of the Moment. It goes like this. There's a great essay written by Sigmund Freud called On Transience, and in it he cites a conversation he had with a poet Rilke as they were walking along this beautiful garden. At one point, Rilke looked like he was about to tear up, and Freud said, "What's wrong? It's a beautiful day. There's beautiful plants around us. This is magnificent." And Rilke says, "Well, I can't get over the fact that one day all of this is going to die. All these trees, all these plants, all this life is going to decay. Everything dissolves into meaninglessness when you think about the fact that impermanence is really a real thing. Perhaps the greatest existential bummer of all is entropy. Perhaps that's why when we're in love, we're also kind of sad. There's a sadness to the ecstasy. Beautiful things sometimes can make us a little sad, and it's because what they hint at is the exception. A vision of something more, a vision of a hidden door, a rabbit hole to fall through, but a temporary one. I think that, ultimately, is kind of the tragedy. That is why love simultaneously fills us with melancholy. So that's why sometimes I feel nostalgic over something that I haven't lost yet, because I see its transience. So how does one respond to this? Do we love harder? Do we squeeze tighter? Or do we embrace the Buddhist creed of no attachment? Do we pretend not to care that everything and everyone we know is going to be taken away from us? I don't know if I can accept that. I find myself siding more with the Dylan Thomas quote, "Do not go gently into that good night, but instead rage against the dying of the light." I think that we defy entropy and impermanence with our films and our poems. I think we hold on to each other a little harder and say, "I will not let go. I do not accept the ephemeral nature of this moment. I'm going to extend it forever, or at least I'm going to try. I will not let go. I do not accept the ephemeral nature of this moment. I'm going to extend it forever, or at least I'm going to try. Isn't that our problem? We try so hard to make our life and the things that we love in it stay. We think somehow we can make it last forever. Somewhere there's a way to make it remain. We just haven't found it yet. But actually, no such thing exists. We might defy impermanence with our films and poems, but they have no power to stop the constant change. Nothing we can do, nothing we can discover, can do that. It is in the very fabric of our existence. And so, the next point in our consideration of death is that it is inevitable because lifespan continuously declines. In other words, death's approach is inexorable and constant. Namkapel in Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun says, not only is your lifespan brief, but it decreases continually. As years are exhausted by the passings of months, months by the passings of days, and days by the passings of nights. He quotes a verse from Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life. Life is always slipping by, can never be increased. Why will death not come to one like me? And then he also quotes examples from the text, Special Verses Collected by Topic, by Dhammatrata, which I personally haven't come across before. The verses go like this. Just as weaving yarn stretched back and forth across a loom finally runs out, so too does every person's life. Just as every step of one condemned brings him ever closer to the executioner, so too is every person's life. Just as the flow of a waterfall can never be reversed, so a person's life runs on without increase and beyond a recall. Hard to find and yet so brief, and giving rise to so much pain, lives are quickly destroyed like the writing of a stick on water. Just as the shepherd with his staff drives his flock into the fold, so old age and sickness deliver people to the Lord of Death. He then quotes the extensive Sport Sutra, which says, the three realms are as fleeting as the autumn clouds. The birth and death of beings unfolds like a play. Their lives, rushing like a mountain stream, vanish like a flash of lightning. In his commentary, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says there are other reasons why we can expect our death to come for certain. He says, first, there are various things that can happen to us, causes within us. We get old and everything degenerates. The power of medicine to cure us weakens and we die. Second, there's no addition coming to our lifespan. It is constantly decreasing. Of course, there are prayers and certain long-life pujas and practices like that, but to increase the actual lifespan is difficult. The basic lifespan that we have comes from the positive force, karma, and so forth that we've built up in previous lifetimes. Just as the days are constantly passing, if last year we had 100 years left of our lifespan, this year there would be only 99. And no matter what length lifespan we might imagine, we can see that between this morning and now, part of that has passed. Our lifespan passes away with each breath, with each moment. The time is constantly passing. It's not going to wait. We cannot sit back and stop our lifespan even for a moment. There's no place to go, nothing we can do to avoid the constant running out of time we have left to live. And then His Holiness goes on, there are many metaphors for life passing away. For instance, like the water in a waterfall, once it starts going over the edge, there's no way it can stop. It must continue falling down. Or like a stream constantly flowing past. Think how quickly life passes. Like a flash of lightning blazing through the sky, it doesn't stop for a moment. It just passes by. So that is the second of the points to consider while contemplating the inevitability of death, that our lifespan is decreasing instant by instant and there's nothing we can do about it. We have to accept and work with it. The third point, as Namkapel puts it, is the way to think about the certainty of death and the rarity of being able to practice the doctrine in this life. Now, if you look back on your life up to now, how much has been devoted to practicing the Dharma in a wholehearted way? Think about a typical day's activities. We wake up in the morning, shower, dress and have breakfast. Then maybe go off to work or see the kids off to school. The rest of the day may be spent in earning our daily keep or doing the daily chores and routine activities we've set ourselves up for. Then in the evening, perhaps dinner and some relaxing entertainment or a few hours of study and then off to bed to sleep for around 8 hours. How much of that time is actually spent in Dharma practice? And that is how our life goes day after day, month after month, year after year. When we try to calculate how much time we've spent transforming the mind, we see that it's very little. Namgya Pal quotes Geshe Chikawa when he writes, "Out of 60 years, if you take away the time spent on livelihood and sickness, there's barely 5 years directed towards the doctrine." He also quotes the sutra on entering the womb, which says, "Half our lives are spent asleep. Until we are 10, we are children, and after 20, we grow old. Then there are hundreds of other obstructions, misery, lamentation, suffering, depression, even quarreling, and various physical ailments which limit our opportunity to practice." He also quotes birth stories, which says, "Alas, the world is filled with disturbing emotions, is unreliable and an unpleasant place to live. The glory of this water lily will soon become but a memory. Such is the fate of all beings. It is surprising that people still do not feel afraid, even though all the roads are blocked by the Lord of Death. They are thoughtlessly lost in enjoyment. The destructive enemies, disease, old age and death, are powerful and unavoidable. When they are certainly heading for danger in future lives, how can the wise enjoy any happiness?" And finally, verses from the letter to King Kanuka, which go, "The Lord of Death is merciless. He kills a skillful man for no purpose. When death is so fast approaching, what wise man can live at ease? And eventually the invincible warrior will shoot his unbearable arrows. Before the inevitable occurs, it is in our interest to be prepared." His Holiness in his commentary says that if we consider how much we have slept this year, we will see that it is at least half of the year. If we take a period of 60 years for this life, the first 20 are sort of wasted, fooling around, he says. Think of the time one is actually able to divert to put it to any use. If we add all the time spent in these 60 years sleeping, eating and being sick, if we discount all that time, there's probably a period of only about 6 years left. Actually, think about how much time during the course of a day is wasted in all sorts of trivial activities taking care of the body. He then quotes one great Lama who wrote in his autobiography, "I spent my first 20 years never getting down to really doing my practice. The next 20 saying, well, I'll get into it any day. And I've spent the last 10 years saying, oh, I wish I could have gotten into my practices earlier. That is how I've wasted a perfect human life." And isn't this more or less how we lead our lives? If you look back on your life so far, can you say you haven't wasted a minute of it? I can't certainly say that. In fact, it is exactly as His Holiness says. Looking back on my life, most of it has been doing anything but Dharma practice, even after becoming a monk. His Holiness admits it is not so with everyone, there are exceptions, but in general, in our first 20 years, we're not seriously interested in self-improvement. He says, the next 20 years of our life, we're involved in setting ourselves up, making a living, and then we're always procrastinating, saying, well, first I have to establish myself and do all these various things. So 10 years pass, then 30, then 40. Then we start thinking, now I'm getting old. I can't do anything. I can't see so well anymore, so I can't strain my eyes. I can't hear very well and have to listen too hard to understand anything someone is saying. We give up our aspirations to learn. This shows how difficult it is to actually realize a spiritual life. It's much easier to simply live a worldly one. So, if we're really going to lead a spiritual life, we cannot always put it off or put it off until we are older. We'll find that we won't be able to do what we had hoped and have only a great deal of remorse, wishing we had trained ourselves earlier. If we're going to lead a spiritual life, a religious life, this is something we have to do with great resolve and determination from this moment on, right now. His Holiness says that the responsibility lies with ourselves. The Buddha has shown us the path to follow, but whether we do it is totally up to us. He says, the nature of life is instability, changing from moment to moment. The force of life is quite weak and cannot be relied upon. So, as wandering beings whose lifespan is continually passing and disintegrating, when we realize our situation, we realize that we're on the verge of just falling off, right out of this lifetime. If we live out our lives completely ignoring this reality, that is truly pathetic. The three points indicating the inevitability of death are: death is inescapable, it is approaching inexorably closer and closer every instant, and if we don't make a special effort to realize a spiritual path, life will pass away meaninglessly. We now move on to three points that lead us to realize that the time of death is uncertain. The Buddhist cosmology mentions that lifespans in some places are definite. In other words, beings will live for a certain determined time. However, it is easy to see that in this world, that is not so. We cannot say how long any creature will live, and especially not ourselves. And this can, of course, pose a major problem if we're not prepared to die. And as most of us put death on the back burner, we certainly don't intend to make any preparation for death other than writing a will. In general, we have the idea that we will die when we're old, sometime in the future. We may read the newspaper accounts of people who died long before they were old, but we usually don't identify with their predicament. We have the conviction, it won't happen to me. But that is just deluding ourselves. Today I read an account of a 24-year-old woman who fell to her death in the mountains in Norway while going to pose for a photo on a rock some 700 meters above the ground. She wasn't doing anything exceptional. Lots of people have their photos taken on this rock, and she was part of a queue of people waiting to have it done. She just slipped at the wrong time. Every day the news has items about people of all ages who've died. The most famous current one is 3-year-old Aylin Kurdi, the Syrian refugee boy who drowned off the Greek island of Kos. People of all ages die, not only the aged, and from all sorts of causes. Maybe we don't go near tourist rocks jutting out hundreds of meters above our ground level, or need to overcrowd dinghies carrying refugees. But that doesn't mean we don't, in our day, do things that could potentially lead to death. A quote from special verses collected by topic in Namkapel's text tells it well. It says, "Of many people seen in the morning, some will not be seen in the afternoon. And of many seen in the afternoon, some will not be seen the next morning." And also, "Since many men and women have died in the prime of life, what guarantee is there that this one will not die because he's young? Some die in the womb, and some immediately they're born. Some die when they can crawl, and some when they've started to walk. Some die when they're old, some are young and in the prime of life. Everyone passes away by turn, like the dropping of ripened fruit." His Holiness the Dalai Lama comments, "In history, there are legends of immortals in the far distant past. They lived immeasurable lifespans. But these days, we certainly don't have anyone like that anymore. If we ask, since we're all going to pass away, when death will come, there's no certainty about the time. And that's the second point. It's very clear that no matter where we go in the world, there's no certainty as to when exactly our life will end. Right here on this earth, the reality is that there is no definite lifespan. If we look at many people in this world, they're not willing to face the reality of death. There are lots of places where retired old people are completely unwilling to accept the fact that they're going to die. They spend all their time as tourists, traveling the world, dressing up very fancily, wearing a lot of makeup, and trying to look young, in an attempt to run away from the reality of their lives. But they need to prepare their minds in terms of when and where death will come. Once, after a medical examination, the doctor told me, there's 100% sure guarantee that you'll live to the age of 60. But I gave the guarantee back. What is sure is that nobody can ever guarantee what will or won't happen in a fixed period of time. That's His Holiness. Now, if we sit down and think carefully about what could cause our death, it will become pretty obvious that we are absolutely surrounded by killer things and circumstances. Our motor car is a blatant example. It's a very convenient thing as a motor car, but is also a moving death trap if we're not careful. Actually, even if we are very careful, a car can be a death of us. It takes just one other person on the road to make a mistake, and as careful as we may be, we could be dead. But it's not only the car. America Online had an article in 2013 that explored the worst household appliances for harm. You will notice that not many deaths due to appliance were recorded, but a lot of injuries. However, the article doesn't go into how bad those injuries were or if people later died of the consequences of the mishap. This is how the article went. The washing machine, dishwasher, and microwave may be lifesavers when it comes to helping you escape the misery of domestic drudgery. However, if you're unlucky, then these life-saving household appliances can become killers. So what are the deadliest household appliances? Around 70 people are killed every year and 350,000 people are injured as a result of a fire caused by an electrical appliance. These may be faulty models or they may be used incorrectly. The figures show that most of the problem is misuse, but in 2012 alone, almost 8,000 fires were the result of faults. Either way, it's worth being aware of the risks. So the Electrical Safety Council has listed the appliance most likely to cause fires. The first is ovens. Cooking appliances, including ovens and microwaves, account for the most fires and injuries in the UK. In 2012, they started almost 12,000 fires, causing almost 1,500 injuries and 10 deaths. There are models with flaws which can cause the fires, but often this is a case of misuse. And then wiring and plugs. This may seem so simple that they cannot cause the problems, but faulty or aging wiring and plugs, or too many plugs in a single adapter, can easily start a fire. They were responsible for 3,899 fires in 2012, causing 223 injuries and 10 deaths. One major culprit is overloading sockets. With more gadgets than ever in the home, often the minimum number that are added as standard are not enough. So we overload each socket with adapters and extension cables. The Norfolk Fire Service advises, if in doubt, pull it out. The rule is one plug per socket, especially if the appliance takes a lot of power, like a kettle. And then washing machines and tumble dryers. A Which survey actually claimed that washing machines and tumble dryers are the biggest fire risk of all. They caused 1,083 fires and 80 injuries in 2012. Most fires here are the result of faults. Sometimes electrical wiring shorts and causes a fire. Alternatively, the friction of an incorrectly revolving drum can cause sparks. A lint buildup in a dryer can also contribute to the risks. And then lighting. Faulty sockets, poorly installed lights, loose chocolate boxes where light fittings are attached to the wires, and faulty side lamps or night lights can all cause electrical fires. However, you also have to watch for where bulbs can come into contact with light shades. A knock can cause the bulb to touch the side of the shade, and the heat will eventually lead to a fire. In 2012, lighting caused 767 fires, 74 injuries and a death. And finally, dishwashers. These caused 470 fires and 68 injuries in 2012. The government's fire statistics show that overwhelmingly these were caused by faulty products rather than misuse. And the experts stress that this is why it's so important that we don't leave these appliances running while we go out, just in case a fault develops. With that, we may say goodbye before time is up. Thanks for being with us today. Hopefully you'll tune in again next week. Please dedicate any positive potential to the enlightenment of all sentient beings. Thank you and goodbye.